Welcome back to It Starts With You podcast with me, Mark Hopkins. And in this episode, I get to speak to a good friend of mine, although he won't admit it, Scott Carrick, about the importance of training and developing your team. It doesn't really matter if it's just recruitment based, by the way. You can take this into sales or to any other kind of role. The important part is you're training and developing people and why it is important. So I hope you enjoy. It's Scott Carrick. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Look, in every podcast I've done now, I was supposed to put audience in and it hasn't. No, I haven't got a studio audience. That's the problem.
Well, you're useless, aren't you? Sort it out.
But we did. It would be more canned laughter with you, though, throughout the world, like a sitcom, this would be.
Just one person clapping.
Yeah, well done.
To thank my mum for coming.
Yeah, well done. Well done, Mrs. Carrick. Thanks for coming.
No, don't say Mrs. Carrick. Oof.
Oh, really? Oh, she's not Mrs. Carrick, is she? Okay.
I say, if you'll have your legs there.
Sorry, Mum Carrick. Was that your wife? I don't know.
Yeah, Mrs. Carrick is my wife now, to be fair. I think you better response there than you would from my mum.
It's really weird. When we were in a restaurant once, the waiter said, a table for Mrs. Hopkins. My mum went, yeah. And my wife went, no, I booked it. It was like, oh, yeah, that's fucking true.
Oh, yeah, we are the same person in some kind of strange way.
Yeah. Scott, tell everyone a little bit about yourself. What do you do? Who are you? Where'd you come from? Why?
I work at Major Players. So Major Players are the biggest design creative agency in the UK. I've been here for about 6 months now, and I head up all the training. I think my official title is Head of Training and People Development, which is very grand. So I involve the training at all levels, from your resources, never done it before, through to your board directors, getting external training involved, as well as building my own content and actually trying to get it fit with the business plans as we go along. Alongside that, I do coaching, I do mentoring schemes, and I also do a lot of the HR here as well.
Loads of hats.
And then actually, you know, occasionally telling people how to help their desk and how to build and what to do there as well. So it's a lot of group stuff, a lot of group sessions in rooms, and actually doing things on the theoretical side, and then coming together and sitting with people on desk and actually making it work.
Yeah. That's a big ask of one person to do.
It is, but it's not really one person, because all the managers, all the team leaders have to get involved in doing it as well.
It's correlated. It's like a trying to tune an orchestra together, isn't it? And trying to bring everyone to kind of sing from the same hymn sheet.
I've never thought of it that way, but that works.
There we go. I'm full of this epiphany. I've been doing it all week. It's an extraordinary job being an internal trainer. You can start becoming a feedback loop, can't you? And not on training the same stuff and not realizing it's not doing anything. You mentioned external trainers there and other sources. Is that what you have to? You targeted to do that? Is that how you kind of develop your training skills?
Not necessarily. So I mean, I might go on external courses, or I might go on a seminar or an event, and that'll influence what I do and put into the material. But sometimes people just come along, so you become aware of somebody they have a really specialist skill set in a certain area. Why fight that? Mm. That makes more sense to go along with that. They're the expert in that area. Let them do that bit, and then you tie that back into what you're doing with the rest of the business.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Training is really important in companies. How much training do you think people should get per, I don't know, you tell me actually, how is it per hour, per week, per year?
That's really difficult to answer. Just cheers for that, make it tough. It depends on what you want to classify training as, and it sounds really corporate and horrible, but training doesn't have to be somebody standing in front of you teaching you what to do. They don't have to be sat next to you on your desk. You can take a hell of a lot of your own training by watching stuff, listening to stuff. So listening to podcasts like these are still part of your training. A lot of the things that seem to work are epiphany moments, where the stuff that you've been told elsewhere and by other people all of a sudden makes sense.
Yeah. So
you need to be going through training every week. I mean, for me, it's at least an hour a week you need to be putting into your own training. But whether that's a group session or whether that's something on your own, it really varies person to person.
I got you. I remember when I used to manage people, I used to say to people, spend a couple of minutes reading a blog about something that will hopefully advance your business forward. And it turned into from a couple of minutes to 2 hours on a Friday afternoon, which I know you don't like the idea of, but 2 hours on a Friday afternoon. And I called it self-development time. And I let people just do it as a manager, just learn something new. And I found that really fascinating how people suddenly become thirsty for knowledge and self-development. Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because you give them one little bit of information, and then all of a sudden that spirals out of control and they found another area that they're really interested in. And then that affects work, and very, very rarely is that a negative effect.
Yeah, it's always a positive effect. And then they want to go on courses, they want to learn about stuff. For me, it was NLP. I started learning about NLP and I wanted to go on a course. So I was like, put me on it. I really want to get on it. And have my mind completely blown away.
Well, you speak about it quite a lot with me. So I've always said it's probably the next big one on my agenda to do some kind of an NLP practitioner's course. I think they do 2 day courses in it.
Yeah.
I think that's the next one for me, maybe in the next 6 to 9 months to go and do that.
I highly recommend it, especially someone in your position as well doing training, because there's elements of it you can then take away from it, especially going into things like, new starters kind of projecting and kind of centering themselves and working on what they are and how they do things. And then obviously team leaders and especially managers as well, understanding different personalities, different people. Mm-hmm. Seeing them from, this is an important one of NLP, perspectives, first person, third person, even a fourth person perspective as well in conversation. So I find it fascinating. This is why I find what you do fascinating, because it's the only reason why we're friends, mate, by the way.
I wouldn't go that far.
True. Free training. That's all I get from now.
As soon as you stop paying me to talk to you, then that's it. I'm gone.
Keep sending me the PDFs. No, I'm joking. So in the last kind of, how long have you been doing training for now? You've been a few years now.
Actually, yeah, better off looking at my LinkedIn profile. I think 4 or 5 years, somewhere along those lines.
You've got to get it right so your bosses don't know you're lying. I'm joking.
Yeah. So it was midway through one of my roles, and so it's really quite hard to remember exactly when it crossed over. So I went from being a recruiter, online recruiter, to being HR, L&D, internal recruitment, and it kind of happened overnight within the same company. So it's really hard to remember exactly when that was, but it was about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, because that transition from recruiter into training is not one that's, it's probably the hardest transition in recruitment.
Yeah, it was really difficult. Really difficult.
Because suddenly you're going from billing or speaking to clients to now speaking to classrooms of people, delivering content, basically.
Yeah. And what you also have is you've got people there who knew what you were like as a consultant. So they knew what your strengths and flaws were. So whether you had the right answer, the right approach that came from either you or other people around you, they knew what you were strong at anyway. So it was very easy for them to either jump on board and go with you or to quite easily undermine you.
Or challenge the shit out of you. And that's the one thing.
I don't mind challenging. Challenging's fine. It's the undermining that can become more difficult to manage.
Yeah, and it's even more difficult because you haven't gone into a manager's role promoted within the team, which I find is a very difficult thing to suddenly manage people you've been working with as colleagues. But you haven't, the only authority you have in theory is like you're the person in front of the classroom of people. That's it. Yeah. You know, undermining then is even more hard and difficult.
Yeah, exactly.
In those years then, so in the last 4 or 5 years, How have you found training? Has it changed? Are companies training differently? Is the methodology the same? Or
so every place I've worked has done it slightly differently at the very least. I think the principles of what they want out of it are generally the same, but how they go about it is different. And that sometimes it's just because of the place it is, the culture of the environment, how they want people to be. Sometimes it's simple things like certain hours of the day. We don't want to go down the line of saying core hours. There's certain hours in the day that a certain team are busy. So it's not a one size fits all. And originally when I went into training, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
It would be. And it is just not. So I've done management training schemes 3 times now. And one place wanted it done in big chunks. So like like sending somebody on an external course, but done internally.
Yeah.
You have five people of roughly the same level, all leading some form of management development, and they would have four whole days or eight half days with you in the boardroom, the training room, whatever it was. Whereas in other places, it was worked a hell of a lot better to do those separated down just to the hour. So you'd have an hour doing a particular subject, send them away. So then that course would end up taking 3 to 4 months. Whereas in the place I mentioned before, it'd be less than a week.
Wow, God.
So it's the same premise, the same idea that comes through it, but very, very different execution. And I've seen pros and cons in both. It's not a situation where somebody takes away all of it if you do it one way, or none of it if you do it the other. There are these constant tweaks and changes as you go along and working with those people to apply the bits that need to be applied when they become relevant.
Yeah, that's important actually, to instead of overloading someone with so much information that they only retain something like 4% or something like that, don't they?
It depends on the person as well and how they learn their own style, but it's quite often 10%, I think, or 4, 5, 10%, that kind of thing. So they talk about 70-20-10 quite a lot.
Yeah. And then, like you say, learning styles, some people are cerebral, some people are visual and so forth. And then, you got to deliver them that content. That side. Over the time that you've seen the different places are doing different methodologies of training, has the content changed? Are one company hammering the shit out of like something like sales and that's it? All you're doing is sales, or are they trying to be varied in the development of recruiters?
Yeah, so I've worked in a couple of places, where it's been heavy based on billing. So let's just get billing. Let's not worry about everything else. Actually, just get the final gross profit higher. That's the outcome that everybody wants, but they're not too worried about the methodology of it. So if it's really hard, it could be a really difficult environment to work in, but they expect a lot. Let's just drive those sales. Whereas actually where I am now, it's driving the person. Driving the experience they're having, making sure they're comfortable with what they're doing, their understanding is there. So, and it's on an individual basis, not on a team basis. Normally, it's that one person who's doing 100 grand now. They need to be 20% better, so it needs to be minimum 120. And that works to a degree. It makes people better. It makes them better at technique, but it puts a hell of a lot of pressure on. And it doesn't actually take into any consideration where that 20% is coming from. So, a lot of the time, I've seen that 20% actually come from people who put under the same pressure. And can't manage it, so they leave. So they're getting an extra 20% from that side. Whereas actually where I am now, very, very much people-focused, and they have that line right. So you look after the person, you work with that person themselves, and you put pressure on for them to do well. But actually I've seen most of the time, people put more pressure on themselves than the business does, because they want to do well. It's a place that people actually want to stay at and do well. So it might take a little bit longer, but it seems to have more legs, more traction, and actually does work.
So is that the type of training then, that a little bit of trickle for weeks and weeks and weeks, and you're just giving them just enough information to develop themselves a bit more and then trickle a bit more, or do you come full on with stuff?
I think it's deliberate in a different way. So if you give people too much information, for me, it doesn't retain as much as you want anyway. And in my own personal experience, when I've been given 3 or 4 things to work on in my own professional development or personal development, I only fix one. And then normally something else suffers. So just focusing on the little bits is where I am at the minute. Actually, just think of it like a sales call. If you find out one piece of information on your best client that you didn't know before, you're in a better position. And I think of it the same in training. If they come away with one extra little bit they can do it well, then you build that up over the course of a year. By the end of that year, they're a very, very good person to
make. Got you. With kind of everything that you've taught at the moment, or everything that you're training people with at the moment, what do you think is the best methodology of training? Which is the most kind of successful? Is it a classroom? Do you have to sit in front of someone and see some slides, or on the go, like, you know, just a manager and a consultant?
I think that the best is a combo. There isn't one that works across the board, because most of the time, the vast majority of training starts when somebody's new in a business, whether they're new to recruitment or not. And at that point, you very rarely know how they learn unless you've worked with them before. So I prefer a three-stage one, for lack of a better word, some kind of theory that they have to read, they have to analyze, digest themselves, and make had some thought process of, then some kind of group session where you're learning from a trainer, somebody like me, but at the same time you're learning from the other people in the room who've got their own ideas of what's going on. And then you've got a practical approach, so that you're sent away with something to physically do, physically implement, and it's up to that person, their manager, and the person in charge of the R&D to get that embedded into how they work. So you all generally cover their learning style, and it's how they implement that then that you work on afterwards.
Yeah, I got you. But you don't beat them up during those three stages if one of them they're not very good at.
One of them should work in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if they were really receptive to all three.
Do you guys, and I don't know if you've got this experience in the past as well, do you, when you get someone that's experienced with 10 years experience and they come into your business fresh, is it worth treating them like someone that's got no experience, or do you have to tailor a training course for someone like that?
I think it's really dangerous to be patronizing if you do either of those. If you think they know exactly what they're doing, or you treat them like they've never done it, I think it can be really, really quite patronizing to do so. So I think you actually have to leave them for a little bit just to bed themselves into the company. Not skills necessarily. You do an induction process, you teach them who's around, ways of working, the general processes of working within the place, which is where everybody has to learn whenever they go to a new job. But then if you make the training a bit more personal, so actually let's have a look at what are you struggling on? Is it a new sector for you? Is the way that this company operates different to what you had before? Are you struggling in a certain area because you can't get through? Did you think it was going to be easier, and actually you realize you've got post-termination restrictions in place and you don't know where to target in the market? And I've found with those experienced people, it's a different thing they struggle with each time.
Yeah, I've been here, by the way. I've been in this a few times, and I've started in different companies. And I the one thing I remember, and now I look back on it with hindsight, though, where I've really struggled in the company is because no one's kind of identified, right, you're weak in this area, instead of taking that opinion, oh, you're shit at this. Do you know what I mean? That's like, come on, you know, if I'm weak in an area, I look back at it now thinking, why didn't you just take me and put me into and show me why I'm doing that wrong, or show me where I'm going wrong. It wasn't, oh, you've got 10 years experience, you've got 15 years experience, you should be able to do that, so why aren't you doing it?
Yeah. I've done some sessions recently where actually I put little teasers into scenarios like that. So name it, like, this person's got 6 years experience. I'm making people realize that the years experience is largely irrelevant. If somebody's struggling, they're struggling regardless.
Yeah.
They need help. It doesn't matter if they've been doing it for 3 months or 30 years. If they're struggling in an area, they need help.
Yeah, I agree with that. Totally agree. You find it with some recruiters get themselves into a job within recruitment, and it's mostly account management, but they're called a top biller, or they're called the best performer, but they haven't done any BD. So when they go now and get another job because they were made redundant or thrown out of the business or whatever it is, normally thrown out. And then they go and do this new job, and they look at them and go, well, you've got 10 years experience managing top level clients, and you've made millions of pounds. Why can't you do a BD call? I haven't done it for 10 years. So then you need
something. No, not even that. Sometimes they come in because I didn't have to set up that relationship. The relationship was already there. I just had to manage it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one as well. Yeah. They don't know how to start up a desk because they keep it warm in the last desk that they did.
So how many times have we seen somebody who was in the right place at the right time? It could be their boss is going off for another job, staying up in another sector. They're actually leaving the area completely. They get married and have a bit of time off. They have kids. And somebody just looks after that area, and it spirals out of control. But it spirals and becomes this absolute monster. And then it looks like you've won it, and you haven't. Oh, you've done this kind of facilitated something to start with, and then maximize the relationship rather than go out there and develop a business with that being the plan.
Yeah. And this is where, I mean, from the outside of it, where I see people set up on their own, where they had a real good time in a company and they did really well, and they go outside and they suddenly realize they're lacking in massive amounts of different of business development skills or building the desk skills. They thought, you know, when they were there, they were making hundreds of thousands of pounds a year. They thought they could just do that for themselves, and not realizing the sphere of influence your own company has is a big one as well. But on top of that, all the development that you need to do to develop that.
Yeah. I mean, I know about myself, even when I was doing well, there's things I was doing badly. And it's a lot of the time about somebody pointing that out and saying, well, you're doing all right this month, but if you continue the way you are, you're going to have no jobs in 2 months' time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes you need somebody to point that out. So yes, I'm busy finding my candidates to fill these jobs, but what happens next quarter?
That's where a good manager comes in to help you with that. And that's a good little segment to move into the importance of being a leader. And how do you train leaders? Is that one of your things that you do within Major Players?
We talk about leaders and management as in general. So I think if you're going to teach a leader, you teach leadership techniques, teach about leadership style. But everybody's a leader. It's just whether they're effective in doing it.
Ah, so I like that. That's interesting.
You can be a leader with absolutely nobody following you.
Feels like me.
You are a leader. You've got people coming on this, you're doing all right in some way, but you can be a leader. All you're doing is leading yourself, leading your own personal life. You are making decisions day to day on how to do things yourself. And you may follow somebody else, but you're a leader of your own life, your own destiny. Now, effectively, really good leaders, they'll have a following and a bigger following. Weirdly enough, ineffective leaders or bad leaders, they'll still have a following.
That's I find fascinating. Even though they're ineffective, even though they're really poorly human beings, I was going to use them, but just poorly attitude around people, they still have people that will listen to them and follow them, which is just it's extraordinary psychology. That I think that makes more sense about them than it does about the leader, though. But
well, people do often gravitate to the same thing. So if you ask people who their role model is, it's normally because of something they've done or a behavior that they want to have or like a richer story that they can relate to. It's more about the person who's chose to follow the leader than the leader itself. So it's actually using those skills for good rather than evil in the nicest possible way.
Yeah, but you can't be full-on leader, can you? You've got to have some element of management in there as well, haven't you?
I think there's so much work done on management, leadership, and the difference, and they're so entwined as well. But I mean, generally speaking, I think management is about getting a task done. Just something has to be done, it has to be managed to be done properly. Leader is how it's done, why it's done.
Yeah. So if you can be that part where you explain why and how, then the task is more than likely going to be done effectively.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't always have to be explained the why and how, it's just inherent that is how we operate. Like your own identity. This is what's going on. Let's do it.
Yeah. That's probably a loaded question by saying, is there an effective methodology of becoming a better leader? My management training came from a company called Silent Edge, and they had different leadership styles. If I remember them off the top of my head, consult, join, sell, and tell. Is that right? Is that
another one? There is one. I'm not sure whether I don't think I've gone through that one. We've been using the Gallup's report, strength-based leadership.
Come across that. But with
that one's quite interesting, but that's huge. I mean, you've got, like, I think it's 44 different attributes of a leader.
Oh, for God's sake, yeah. But I think they slimmed it down to these four, because in recruitment it's easy. You've got people that you sell to, so you're trying to sell them what they need to do, convince them to do it, tell them what to do, which is the strain of management that you just explained. And then consult and join. Join is something that you do with someone that seems to be capable of doing it. So you don't need to tell or sell them. You just got to join with them. So you just give them nudges and say, hey, you're doing all right. Keep it going. You're doing all right. You know, I mean, giving that advice. And then the consult part of it is literally the people who just fly in. You don't need to give any management. You're just there as a sounding board. That's all you do, basically.
It sounds like it ties into your skill and will, like your skill and will matrix. So you have four different areas. So if you've got high skill and high will, then you're likely to be doing very well. If you've got high skill but low will, you're probably just kind of plodding along, that type of thing. If you've got low skill, low will, then you're really struggling.
Correct. And that is a part of that as well. I think when we did it, or when I did it, it was like nearly 10 years ago now. But when I did it, skill and will was a massive contributor in there, because when you analyzed your staff and you saw that they were high skilled, zero willed, then you know what you had to then create a strategy around that. It was like a 10-point thing. It was amazing. Then you change your management structure for them, and it was more like high skilled, low willed. Then you needed to sell to them a little bit more, kind of get back in the business. And then it was I'm trying to remember this. This is you're testing me now, Scott. And if they're high willed and high skilled, consult. That's all you have to do.
Yeah,
with them. It was,
just help. Give extra challenges. Keep them where they are.
Yeah, I loved that. I loved all that stuff. I really did. I miss doing it. Running my own ship, I'm going to do it to my own self.
Just start doing it to the wife and the boy and see how they like it.
They don't know.
Might be booted out in a few weeks.
It's almost my Jedi-like powers there. Do this! No.
Don't tell them to do it. Just hint that it might be helpful for them if they do.
If you're a manager right now and you're kind of listening to this and you're thinking, I want to be a better manager, I want to get my staff to perform better, at the end of the day, it's all about making money. And if you make more money, you look good. You know what I mean? Your boss is good. So obviously everyone's kind of motivation is around that. What are there practical steps these guys can take to move forward?
So if it's somebody who's already managing a team and they want to do better.
Yeah.
Always think with anything you want to get better at, the first step is understanding where you are now. And then if you've got a team around you to do that, then it's about opening up those doors and having, they call it in kind of HR world and CIPD world and 360 feedback. And it can be really, really taxing. It can be really eye-opening for you that a thing that you thought you were amazing at, you're really not. But at the same time, when that happens, you normally find something that you thought you were really crap at and you're not. So having that open conversation with the people you're already working with, and saying, right, okay, I want to be better. I want to do this. I want it to work for all of us. And actually having that clear common goal and saying, it's in my interest to be better and manage you better. It's in your interest to have me as a better manager who can help you out. So let's do a 360 feedback. You can anonymize it if you want to and just get that and create your action plan from there.
You've got to have an open mind for this, though, haven't you, as well? Yeah. It's
going to bruise your ego. I mean, I've done it myself as well. It bruises your ego. It hurts. But it's about getting over that.
Yeah.
It takes a couple of days. And you will.
Yeah.
You over every little decision you've made along the way. You'll kind of judge yourself. You'll kick yourself. You'll actually, a lot of the time, you just disagree with it. But it's when you actually reflect on that. So it can't be wrong because this is how somebody feels.
Yeah.
So something's got it to that point. It can't be wrong for somebody to feel a certain way about something you've done.
Strong-willed, haven't you, with that?
Yeah, it's just accepting that it is going to be a tough thing to do. Yeah. But if you're doing it with the right intentions, if you're doing it for the reasons that you want to be better, then eventually you will put your ego aside and think, well, actually, I need to work on this for it to be better, not just for me, but for everybody around me as well. And it's not going to do you any harm.
It's not.
It doesn't mean you can change your weaknesses either. I mean, again, in the strength-based leadership stuff, you talked about managing to your strengths, but it means you can put things in place to caveat your weaknesses. So if you're really abrupt in certain situations, say you've got massive deadlines coming up, you've got to do all your monthly reviews with your team, you're going on holiday the week after as well, you're very, very time limited. And in those kind of situations, you're very short, quite snappy and abrupt with your feedback. Knowing that that's something you do because your team will come back to you and realize the effect you have on that might not stop you do it, but it might mean that you go and apologize for it afterwards.
Or don't do it then. Do it another time.
The likelihood is that, you know, if that's the type of person you are, you're going to snap at some point, but it's how you respond to that as well. And I caveat, say, look, I am working, I'm really sorry, I appreciate that, it wasn't the best thing to do. People will respect that.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily about changing everything you are, but it's putting things in place that will caveat it, or putting people in place that will caveat it. It's another way of doing it.
That's very interesting. And this is the people we're talking about, is the team, isn't it? Or as well as the people above you as well that are going to have to give this on.
People above you, people around you. If you're a manager, do you have a team leader or seniors who've got their own leadership style? Yeah. You know, you don't want three people in senior positions in the same team with the exact same leadership style. Because you all agree on the same things and you all disagree on the same things.
Oh, God. Don't get me started with that. Especially if you're a company that follows psychometric testing before bringing people in and only people you bring in is the same type of people.
Yeah.
then it's
interesting when you go to events and you see companies and they literally look
at that. Oh, no.
Exactly the same. You look at them and go, you are the same person.
Clones. What are the practical steps then that can people take? It's so obviously feedback, finding out where you are in the world is important.
Yeah. You see, the 360 feedback in the first place, actually having that open and the setting of the plan is the bit after that. So it's looking at where you are, where you're operating, you know, your strengths, weaknesses, everything you've got. then it's where you actually want to be. Okay, and what does that look like? How does that work on a professional level? How does it look on a personal level? And then you've got to put the steps in play to actually get there. So I was taught not too long ago, actually, a technique called the 1-3-5 technique.
Yes.
1-3-5 technique is time management technique, it's a business plan technique. And that's the best way I've come to actually put this into real terms. So your one is your long-term goal. Where do I want to be? And that has to be at least 12 months away. I mean, it could be 10 years away. I don't care. But it has to be significantly long-term. Then you have three midterm goals that you want to do, or three midterm tasks that are going to get you to that long-term one, and then five short-term ones. And actually looking at it that way, you can't fix everything overnight. So just look at the things you can fix now.
Joe, it's really funny. I've got a whiteboard right next to me with very similar kind of, and no one's taught me this. This is something I've done myself, actually, with mid, it says things need to be done in this month, so short-term goals, which it seems to be fine, actually. Midterm goals, which is the next quarter, actually says midterm, and long term, which is empty. At the moment, I'm still working through it. But that's really fascinating.
Midterm is 3 to 6 months, generally speaking. But and then when you get to the end of that month, look at them, reassess them, rewrite them. And doing that as you go along as a constant pattern. And just not forgetting the personal things in there as well. I mean, we come to work to live a life. We rarely do it the other way around. What does it actually mean to you? What does it mean in your terms? And if you're not money motivated, then what's it doing for your life instead? What's it facilitating? And actually putting that in real terms. I mean, one of mine I put down on my own personal goals is to have 8 hours uninterrupted sleep. And with a 7-month-old baby, that's not very achievable at the minute.
Virtually impossible. Wait another 5 years. I was going to actually say to you. So these goals, then, they've got to be smart goals. Then they've got to be measurable and achievable, haven't they?
Yeah. Because otherwise, it's not really that
just a useful. List. Yeah, just a list of stuff that you're going to do. Yeah.
I mean, there is research that says there's, I think it's 2% of the population that like an unachievable goal. So they just like to set something that's ridiculous and just see how good they are. But it's a very, very small percentage of people that like to do that. People like to see little wins. I mean, we've all been there where you've had a ridiculous day where you've worked and you put your bollocks off, and you get to the end of the day and go, I don't actually know what I did. And it's so demoralizing.
Yeah. This is what I was chatting on the previous podcast with Tim Woods, and he was talking about no more zero days. And if you can advance forward and think about what you've done advancing forward in that day, it changes you in a different way, and it helps you. If you get to the end of a day and you can't remember what you did that day, you've had a zero day, basically.
Yeah.
So you've got
basically firefighting things that came along. You never actually did anything to project yourself forward.
Yeah. And you've got to, even if it's, like you said, one push-up, do one push-up. If it's, one, speak to that one contractor or one client or something like that, just do it. It's not going to hurt. Just do it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I was fine with smart goals or goals or setting goals. I've had arguments with managers in the past, actually, about this, especially ones which are a little bit kind of too much energy for my liking. And they talk about stretch targets and stretch goals.
Yeah. Yeah,
I find them fascinating because they're so subjective. Do you believe that we should do that? We should stretch our goals in this scenario?
I think we should stretch our comfort zones, but I don't necessarily think we should stretch our goals, because actually getting into a habit of success and being successful will make you want to do more.
Yes.
So if you hit a target that's achievable, you hit that, and then you set another target on the back of that that's achievable, you'll hit that. And then you do the same again, you hit that. It's not like they're easy targets. You have to work towards them.
Yeah, yeah.
But you hit them, you're into a pattern of succeeding. And when you get used to succeeding, you want to succeed more. And that, I think, leads you into being stretch goals rather than necessarily having it in those terms.
So when you're looking from an athlete's perspective, it's great to do 10 laps of a track, but the next stretch goal then is 10 laps within a certain amount of time, and then change that time. But first, you've got to get fit, haven't you? You've got to be...
First, you've got to be able to do the 10 laps.
10 laps, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you can start looking at time. That's how I see recruitment training, by the way. I see it, first you've got to be able to be fit to do the job, pick up the phone confidently. Yeah. Now we're going to pick up the phone 10 times. Now you can pick up the phone 40 times. And but there's no point in trying to say to people, right, you've got to pick up the phone 40 times this week and then beat them with a stick at the end of the week. Why haven't you done that? You've got to teach them how to do that first, confidently. And that's the important part of it.
Really simple things like how to introduce themselves on the phone.
Yeah.
It's really basic stuff, and how that's different with a candidate to a client. Like, what are you going to say when you pick up the phone? Do you go with your first name? Do you go with your full name? Do you tell them where you work? Do you tell them what you do? Do you tell them why you're calling? What order do you do it in? And it seems like really easy, obvious questions, but it's not when you've never done it before.
Yeah, it changes the whole psychology of that conversation as well. Yeah. You know, hi, it's Mark from, and that, or you say the full one, it becomes more formal, and then you can talk in a different. Yeah, it changes. Yeah.
And it's very easy for people to then put on their phone voice, and everybody has one.
Yeah.
You know, the hyacinth bouquet type phone voice that you put on. And actually, it does you no favours. The best people I've ever worked with, and there's a fair few out there, they were always themselves. Always. They were not a posh version of themselves, or a dumbed down version of themselves, or an extremely eloquent version of themselves. They were themselves.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the cycle that people go through is they try to imitate somebody they see as successful and then realize it doesn't work for them.
Yeah. And that imitation of the successful person is, like you just said, they're being themselves, and that's why they're successful. They naturally got that way to do it.
I did it. I had a boss when I first moved to Manchester, and he was very funny, very charismatic, and really quite crass. The jokes were very, very dirty most of the time, and swore all the time. And it worked. And I heard conversations happening that I just didn't think could exist in this kind of way. So I gave that a go. It didn't go well. It did not go well. And I found myself reeling backwards very, very quickly, basically apologizing with my tail between my legs for, I think I said fuck. And it just felt wrong. It felt so, so, so desperately wrong. And then, going around in that pattern, trying to find who I was on the phone, and probably as a 22-year-old, so I was trying to find out actually who I was anyway.
You know, it's an epiphany when you realize you can't swear at a client, by the way, or you can swear with a client. When you get to that moment and you have that moment of swearing, is you've got a completely different relationship with that client by then anyway. But
it's when it comes naturally as well. I've heard
that.
When my wife swears, I notice it instantly because she doesn't swear very often. So it really stands out. Yeah. I'm surprised I've gone this long in this conversation before I said fuck. It just is natural part of my speech. So you can see when it feels weird or it looks weird or somebody's trying not to be themselves. I think that's what stands out more than the actual words they're using.
Yeah, I agree. If you ever watch a kid swear, it's an amazing emotional journey that they go through when they say the swear word, realize they said the swear word, and then apologizing for using it. It's quite funny. And that's
how they're doing it, purely for the reaction is the other side. Yeah. They're doing it because they want to get a little nibble.
But that raw emotion you see in people then doing business development, and they say or do something, and that recoil straight away, you see in their face, and they shouldn't have done it because you're pretending to be someone you're not. That's why you've recoiled. Obviously don't swear at all your clients, but try to be. I'm here.
Judge the situation best.
Yeah.
Don't ring this reception and say, hey, is that a fucking Dave around?
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
although I did say to a client once, because you could, you know, I got this ability to hear the people's voice on the phone, and I can see if they can get a joke or not. And I remember this one, HR, no, receptionist, I think it was. I said, it's another fucking recruiter. I said to her, and she laughed her head off and put me right through to the hiring manager. It was great, but you got to be careful with that. You really have.
Yeah, I mean, if that's not you, I don't think I'd be able to get away with that. And there's certain people, maybe, but only if they knew me, not straight off the bat with a cold call. I feel very strange doing it. But hey, God loves a trial.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing. Cold calls are. It is literally as it says, isn't it? That's what it is under 10, and you've got to come at it in such a way that is beneficial for you as highly as possible.
by not doing them is my first advice to Google's, but that's a different, that's marketing now. Yeah.
Take cold calls out of the equation. Just calls. Having people physically used to speaking to people that they don't know, they can't see is a skill on itself. So yes. I mean, I was lucky enough that I'd worked in call centers, and it was one of those ones where it was all computer operated. You couldn't physically hang up the phone. So by that point, I was a bit desensitized to speaking to strangers. I mean, I had stories from there that were just really odd. Yes. So I came into a job where picking up the phone was fine, but I mean, if you've just come from retail or you come from a marketing background where you basically work on computers, you don't talk to people.
Mm.
Just think how scary it is speaking to random strangers where you don't really 100% know what you're doing. You don't really know the market you're recruiting for. You haven't seen the full process from start to finish. And yet you've got to pretend that you know what you're doing.
Oh, it's scary. That is a scary moment. When I first started doing cold calls, I hated them. I talk about recoil and terror. I tried every excuse not to do them. Honestly, I was terrible at them. The moment of epiphany for me was, I think it was a sales afternoon, and I had a cold and I couldn't be fucking asked. Do you know what I mean? So I just picked up the phone and I just realized, I just started talking. You got a cold, they'd say. And I go, yeah, I'm not feeling very well at the moment. Oh, why didn't you go home? And then suddenly I realized they're humans on the other end of this phone. And I'm speaking to humans, and I remember never worrying about them ever again. What I now do with them, though, because you know I'm a little bit more kind of different to most people out there, I stop making cold calls and start making warm calls. So there's a process I need to go through before I start picking up that phone. And I guess that's a technique I gave my staff when I was a manager to do first, to stop them sitting there crying with a phone book in their hand and worrying about doing cold calls. No, it's not for everyone.
Generally think if you don't know why you're calling, then you should pick up the phone.
That's a brilliant
If you don't know the reason you're calling them beforehand, then there is absolutely no reason you should pick up that phone in the first place. So it's down to you to plan it and make the reason first. Because if you have something to talk about, then you can hear that there's a purpose in the voice.
It is, and especially once you're in that point in your career in recruitment where you've got a candidate and you know your market really well, no call is cold at all whatsoever. It's the beginning part of your career that's the hardest bit, building that desk, developing that desk.
But even if it's not that, I mean, again, early on in your career, how often do you have that red hot candidate who you know he's going to be wanted in the market?
Yeah, it's true.
There's so many other things you can talk about and actually still add value to your clients. It's just looking around at what do you do, what can you do, what can you deliver, and actually just make it useful.
That's where great training and great support from your manager comes in, to be able to deliver that.
If only we knew somebody who did that.
Yeah. So those are the deliverables for managers to think about. Then is the realization, self realization through feedback, 360 feedback, making a list of goals, short term, long term, medium term, long term goals. Is there any other practical tips these guys can do to help them develop themselves? Stop being an arsehole. Is that one of them?
No, because if that's who they are, then they're better off just being who they are. I think what's helped me out massively is exposure. You get siloed into what you do, especially if you're a one company person. So actually just opening your eyes a little bit, talking to other people, other sectors, other managers who've been through it, and having that type of relationship. So you can go and find that now. We're in a world where recruiters are everywhere on LinkedIn. So if that is your area, go and find somebody else. Have a friend or a friend of a friend. Ask your bosses if there's anybody you can recommend as an informal coach, and just learn.
Mm, I like that.
Knowledge is power. It's never going to do you any harm if you know about how somebody else works and operates.
That's a really good point, because a lot of people get promoted into management. They then segregate themselves from anything, any development, any training, any kind of coaching, mentorship,
mentoring,
or being mentors. And then they just sit there in that role. And then you see some companies where someone's been a manager for 25 years, never moved, don't go anywhere. And then when you deal with them, they're a very awkward person to deal with. They're not a very nice person. It's because they siloed themselves in a business.
Or they're becoming defensive because they realize that they've got a particular skill. And if that particular skill is no longer necessary, then what do they do?
Yeah.
But actually, if you just go out there, and it doesn't always have to be something more senior than you. You learn from everybody around you. I mean, I learned so much from people who are brand new in the business and in the recruitment world because they're doing something that I've never done and never will do.
That's fascinating. Yeah, surround yourself with the people that are better than you. I love that theory, actually.
Just different to you. Different.
Different is important. Yeah. If they're not better than you, at least different than you. Different thought process. Yeah.
When we talk about diversity in all the obvious ways, in terms of sexual diversity. Your caste and your BAME background, those kind of things. I do think we have to be diverse in those areas. Just diversity of thought. People who are from different areas, people from different countries, different regional areas, different educational backgrounds. You find people who come to do that, they always pick, we like accounting backgrounds or like law backgrounds and that kind of thing. But why? Mix it up.
Yeah. There was that... I can't remember which accountants did it. They stopped doing graduate programs and they just did people programs, I think it was called. And they just hired people from all walks of life and it enriched their business massively. Which accountancy was that? It was a massive one, wasn't it? One of the top three.
I think quite a few of them are going that way now as well. I mean, we're using a bit of software now and we've whitelisted, we're using the legal industry to track people's socioeconomic background and their change with... The theory says that if you overachieve on your social economical background, then in a professional environment, you continue to overachieve. So if you went to a really, really shit school, I mean, it was average of D's and E's at A level, you managed to get to university with C's, and you've had a tough upbringing, then you've massively overachieved what you should have. And that generally continues into your professional life as well. Whereas if you went to Eton and you're expected to get A's all the way along and you've got B's and C's, that's underachieving.
God, yeah. What did Boris get? Because I think he's an underachiever.
I have no idea, to be honest.
That's a really good point.
Boris is an interesting topic. So we're looking at doing that as another area of our social economical studies and background, and another option to give to clients at the minute. It's actually, don't just look at it as base facts of C. It's what the C means with the rest of the information around it.
That's a really good point, because if you walk into McDonald's and see the guy with the 5 stars and he's 21 years old, hire that guy, because there's a good chance he's a high achiever within the limitation that he's in. You know what I mean?
Nothing went wrong with McDonald's. How's that?
Oh, it's brilliant companies to work for. They've got their own bloody training college and everything. Absolutely.
This
is the thing, though. When you see people highly achieving in what other people call mediocre jobs...
Yeah,
they don't realize that. That's freaking hard to get to that. It's really hard to get to a management level in certain retailers, like Tesco. Yep. It's really hard.
You have to pass all the qualifications before you even
consider. Mate, I was on the traineeship when I was a student. I was on the traineeship to become a manager in Tesco's. And I'm not joking. There's about 7 or 8 folders to get through before you could even get considered to get onto the traineeship. It was massive. And then you had to give your soul away. You had to work days. And you were off.
I'll be all right. I've not had a soul for a few years, to be honest.
True. We're in recruitment. We don't have souls.
I didn't have one when I came in.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
It helped. It was a difficult university. I had to eat somehow, so I sold it.
Yeah. Was that Doncaster, by any chance? No.
No, that's where I grew up. That was where I went to uni.
It's how you get out, isn't it? You sell your soul. That's the thing, though, isn't it? When you think about kind of, I lost my train of thought. Where have I gone with it? when you think about kind of, that was at Tesco's. When you think about kind of these places and how hard it is to do these things and how hard it is to get to them, and if you're achieving extremely well in these areas that people call mediocre, all the shit that you have to get through to get there, it's extraordinary. And I say the same thing with recruitment. You see people climb the ranks in recruitment. I take my hat off to them, because that in its own right is difficult. In this day and age as well, even more harder. Yeah. I'm all right. I just
yeah. Let's just
bypass that.
People do underestimate just how hard it is just to stick around and do it.
I think it's harder today than it's ever been to stick around in a job and do it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 4 years into this, and if I had been working for someone else, I think there's about 10 moments I would have sacked myself. But it's that.
My whole broke up my mark.
Yeah.
I didn't hear a word of any of that.
Oh, did you? Did you? Sorry. What I was saying was, I've been doing this for 4 years, and in the last 4 years, there's about 10 moments I would have sacked myself. Because, but, you know, for that tenacity.
Only 10.
Yeah, exactly. Only 10. You're being modest.
If we want to be particularly harsh, even here, I've made a couple of faux pas. One that you know of, which was relatively in the public eye, that I could have sacked myself for that.
But
we all have them.
But that's I can't speak for the company you work for, but when we talked about that in private and what had happened and stuff, I was quite blown away by the reaction of your managers and how they reacted to it. And I thought, fuck, now these guys are brilliant. Then if this is, can you get me a job? I think I said that. Give me a job. Yeah, then.
I think you did.
But the
I told you we had higher standards than you, so unfortunately we couldn't take you.
Yeah, you know what a Welshman living in Tamworth. No, but seriously, it's the culture that then is created off the back of kind of forward thinking people. Which happens to be the guys running the place there. And I see that as probably the strongest part of a business, is if you've got those type of people, that will cascade down to people like you in the business training that culture.
It's a really strange one to actually put into words as well, as what the culture's like. So I still remember the day I got a job description for this. It was being rewritten, it was changing, and it was according to, you know, what strengths I had as well. There's a bit in there about the benefits and saying genuine, supportive, and collaborative culture. And then instantly in my head, I thought, yeah, of course it is. Who wouldn't say that? And then I came here and I met people and I went, oh shit, no, it actually is. Like 100%. The foundation to everything is support and collaboration. It's like you work together, you work for the clients, you work for your colleagues, you don't work for a transaction. And it just resonates through absolutely everything. And you see what comes out of that is people are far more willing to admit to mistakes they've made, far more to admit that they need help with areas, because the intention is only for people to get better.
That's brilliant, because then you've got an environment of there's no failure, just learns. And then everyone keeps constantly learning and developing themselves.
Yeah. And even when it doesn't work out in a way of very little animosity. And that's almost unheard of in the group, unless we're honest.
Oh, no, it is unheard of, because I've never come across that. It's normally, you don't fit, go. You're kind of like, can we talk about this? Can we do some training? Can we develop me a little bit more? No, go, you don't fit.
Yeah, people who aren't working out, and again, we get it. It's business, some people, sometimes people don't work out. But it's not a surprise. People don't suddenly come in one day and they shuffle out. Mm. It's a constant thing going on. It's a constant discussion. Most of the time when someone leaves, it becomes mutual, because it's just not working for either party anymore.
And that's
a really strange place to be in, where actually you've got people leaving a business and the natural turnover of any business. And it's being done in a way that not only is it amicable, but those people, they could quite easily come back.
That is powerful, by the way. If you are hiring people that left you, rehiring, That shows a different culture, a different company than most. Reed did that to me. I worked twice at Reed. And it was like, oh, you've been around the block now. How did you find it? Enlightenment. Yeah, come back in. See where you get up to now.
See where you can put into practice.
Yeah. And that helps. Going around the block does really help that.
You pick up things and you don't even realize you picked them up.
Yeah. Yeah, true. That is so true. Because when I went in... Well, first time I got, you know, I was 18 months in the job, and then I moved on. And then the second time I came in, I was 4 years, I think, at Reed, and I got promoted in that time. I probably did the best I've ever done in my career in that time as well.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. I realized that was the company I wanted to stay working for by going to another company. That was my first realization. But my second realization is the culture that I thrived and missed. I thrived in, but I missed it, and I didn't have that in the next move I had.
Yeah.
And yeah,
it's very hard to know that you're thriving if that's the only place you've worked.
Yeah, exactly.
In a particular environment. And I mean, I've spoken to people before, and they've moved on and gone, yeah, I really should have done that. They don't go back and have that conversation. You always wonder why not, because you know you're missing. You should go back. Is it because you burn bridges, or is it because the culture doesn't allow it, or is it just pride again anyway?
Oh, it's hugely pride. The people that suck it up and go, I was wrong, they 9 times out of 10 end up going back to the company that they enjoyed working for, because they enjoyed them working there, because there was that women. The latest one I had was not recruitment related, admittedly. It was a company that I work with sales engineer, and three of them all left at the same time, got bigger, better paying jobs in a competitor. And then I think 3 months went by, and the managing director called me up to say, you won't believe who's just called me. And he said, oh, Craig just called me. He wants to come back. I was like, well, why does he want to come back? He's not doing well where he's at. He misses working for me, and he misses what we did. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, you're taking him on? No, I'm not. That was a different matter. But he didn't have time because we filled the jobs. But but the point is, if you're going to do that, then you need a company that is accepting that, hey, you give it a go. Come back. See what happens.
I had where I was before Major Players. I had a guy who worked for me. He's an L&D business partner. He was a specialist in e-learning and actually just content development of that as well. And he never liked the company. He wasn't really a big fan of recruitment. He wasn't a fan of the big sales environment. But he did a very good job on what he did, and he was actually a really, really nice person to be with. He got what sounded like a really good job. He was going to be home based. He was going to work from places around his house, basically. So I think his maximum commute was going to be a half an hour drive. It was a pay rise. It was a promotion. And it was amazing. And we shook hands, and off he went. On the third day of being at a job, he rang me up and said, can we go for a beer? And we went for a beer and had a catch up, and he hated it. They'd lied to him so much. Like, pretty much everything they said to him, they'd lied.
Yeah.
They were going to be flying into Belfast. They were going to be flying into Edinburgh. And he'd be spending 2 or 3 days there and flying back. And he had I think his wife was heavily pregnant at the time.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's the whole reason against why I went, and I don't know what to do. I said, look, well, there's still work there that needs to be done for me. If you want to come back, and we know it's a temporary thing because you want to change what you're doing, then I'll go and speak to the bosses, and we'll see what can make happen. And came back for 9 to 12 months.
Wow.
Found another job that was, again, really suitable for him. We only agreed it 3 months initially, and it just worked and carried on.
Yeah.
And ended up back on a permanent contract. It was a year. I'm pretty sure it was about a year later.
Yeah.
Off he went again, worked for somebody else. We still talk now. He gets on really well. And I was just thinking, it doesn't have to be this big rigmarole. If it's something that either works for their career or works for them personally, celebrate it.
Yeah, I agree with
that. You've done a good job.
Totally. I'll be honest with you. There was a time when I left Reed and I went to this other company. If anyone looks at my LinkedIn, they know who it is. And I went to this company. And
Marcus.
Yeah, Marcus. And I was, in the first week I was there, at the end of the week I felt sick. I made the wrong decision.
Yeah.
What kept me there was the people. The people were brilliant. And I enjoyed that part of it. And I started realizing that, okay, this is all right for me. But then a couple of months into that role, the boss at Reed contacts me and says, do you want to come back? I'm being made redundant, but I want to bring you back so then I've got a team, then I can hand over to someone. I was like, oh, fucking hell. Yeah, yeah. We just couldn't align with salary. That was the only thing.
Yeah.
And then I wish I went back. And even to this day, I wish, but it is what it is, and you move on. And then it ended up great for me because I went in a different direction, and here I am today talking about it.
There you go, talking about our woes and the problems that we make for ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sometimes we can be too quick to decide this isn't for me because, but then we don't.
Because it's not what it was.
Yeah. So that's the thing. You got to give it. I think we got to give things a chance. If you're 2 years into a job and you're freaking hating it, yeah, I think it's time to leave. If you're 6 months into a job and you can't get your head around what's going on, ask, talk about it.
There is a breaking point, but it's when that breaking point happens. I mean, in the first 3 months, if the breaking point's happening there, there's got to be something fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, I agree.
it does happen. I've seen that happen as well. But yeah, it's kind of a sense of what's right for you, what actually matters the most.
I agree with that. That is the point where you've got a desk and there's nothing's going right, and you're smacking your head against the wall and you think it's you. It's not you. It's just you don't fit in that desk. You need to find a new desk to fit in.
So sometimes it's you.
It's more than likely me, as in me personally, but no, do you get what I'm saying? It's that you know, realization. And if you've got a company, I don't know, is Major Players like this? You've got a company and someone puts their hand up and go, I really can't do this desk. Can I try something different? Would you guys be able to facilitate? Cool.
Yeah. But we would expect that person to come up with some form of an idea of what that should be. So we won't just start suggesting things. If you come to the realization, you're mature enough to realize that that particular sector doesn't work for you, then you tell us what sector does.
Got you.
And then we can have a proper discussion about it.
That's good. I'm just looking at my list of stuff that we were going to chat about in this. And I think
we covered most of them.
I covered most of them, yeah. Planning your career, a company. That was kind
of... And the bar's open here now, and I'm missing out on a beer. What's all
that? Oh, dude, I just can't help you. I really can't. I can by ending this... podcast with you.
Bye.
There we go. No, seriously.
You definitely have an 8-minute limit because I do have the roundup that I have to go to in a minute.
Yeah, I know you do. And I'm just trying my best here to close this. Seriously, mate, thank you very much. A lot of people don't know me and you were good friends, so this was a really good...
I've told you, stop telling people that. It's ruining my street cred.
It's lies. Lies.
I didn't have street cred, don't worry.
Yeah, you need cred first to have it.
Yeah. Oh, it's sad because it's true.
Yeah. Seriously, mate, thank you very much for your time. I know there's a couple of instances that we may need to edit at the same time. Brilliant. Thank you very much, mate.
And Always good talking to you. I'm sure I will hear your complaints again next week.
Yeah, speak to you soon.
Bye. See you later, bye.
Training and development is extremely important for our futures and our careers and who we are. And if you're not getting training and development and you haven't got someone like Scott in your business, then ask that question why. And ask that question, you know, what could be done? Don't accept, here's a couple of DVDs, here's a book, here's Mike Walmsley or whoever is bootlegged copy of his training. Don't accept that as training. You need to have it with someone, classroom. Like Scott said, there's three phases that he does. You've got to have it to advance your career forward. I'm passionate about training and development. I think every person in any business should have some sort of program. And that's why I did this podcast with Scott, because we need to highlight that more so in recruitment, because we feel it's not happening enough. Till next time, take care. Bye-bye.